Hello and welcome to this PSG Think Big series podcast. In this program, Alicia Sikkim speaks to Rudy Dix, the head of the Project Management Office at the Presidency, on the topic Policy to Proof. Will Operation Vulindlela 2 deliver?
Hello, you're watching the Think Big series brought to you by PSG. Welcome to it. I'm Alicia Sikkim. Well, Operation Vulindlela, which is a joint initiative between the Presidency and National Treasury, is an ambitious reform drive aimed at achieving more rapid and inclusive economic growth. Phase one kicked off in 2020 with five priority areas. That was electricity, freight logistics, water, telecommunications, and the visa system. And now, phase two, while continuing the work within those parameters, earlier this year introduced three new focus areas, those being local government, spatial integration and housing, and then digital infrastructure as well. Bottom line, phase two put South Africa at a pivotal moment in its reform journey. And Rudy Dix, who's head of the Project Management Office at the Presidency, is co-lead of Operation Vulindlela. And he joins us now to unpack the priorities, progress, but also practical pathways in this renewed commitment to fast-tracking the economic transformation agenda. Rudy, thanks so much for joining us today. So, like I said, Operation Vulindlela was launched to fast-track structural reforms, fast track being the operative words there. And, you know, the plans sound great, as all of South Africa's plans often do. So I'm going to jump straight to the outcomes, especially with phase two now underway. What's your response to criticism that, you know, implementation has lagged far beyond the rhetoric? I mean, we had South Africa act fast to exit the grey list, right? So what does it take to actually replicate that sense of urgency for infrastructure reform?
Operation Vulindlela, and I think there's a bit of a misunderstanding of the speed that we've taken. In my view, I think we've moved pretty fast on much of the reforms that have been there. Let's take the telecommunications reform, Alicia. When we announced that reform, what we needed to do was, of course, create cheaper and faster telecommunications by first auctioning spectrum. We had the auction. It happened quite quick. We'd seen significant amount of investments by much of the telecommunications sector. Electricity, for example, again, we took these decisions in 1998. Now, of course, we could have taken a decision to implement the reforms in 1998. We didn't do that. We announced that the decisions that were taken in 1998 in the electricity white paper would be implemented as quickly as possible. By 2022, 2 years later, we saw a revised electricity regulatory act. We introduced private sector participation in generation, similarly with Transnet as well. So I think we're moving pretty fast in my view. Sometimes I think there's a misunderstanding about people not necessarily understanding some of the complexities of the reforms. When you talk about unbundling, for instance, right? They're quite complex. They're transactional. They require transaction advisors and a whole series of, technical capacity to make that. But I think we're moving pretty fast. And I think there's a bit of critique. And we accept that in some instances. But certainly, I think we've done quite a phenomenal amount of work to get it. Better late than never, I would say.
Better late than never. But I guess people also want to see measurable changes, you know, being delivered on the ground, right? So beyond, that overarching improvement in growth, Rudy, we want to see change, like I say, on the ground. So let's use a practical example. Make something like us seeing more trucks than we possibly ever have before on our roads make sense. If Transnet's making progress, I mean, it's costing us, it's damaging current road infrastructure in the process. So how does a disconnect like that make sense, where you're talking one thing and we're seeing another?
So let's use that as a good example, Alicia. Last year, for the first time ever, we introduced a network statement, and the network statement had two specific things over there, allowing third-party operators or train operating companies, private train operating companies, and for the first time having a transparent access charge, basically charging the train operating companies a fee for using the network, right? By the middle of this year, we were able to allocate that third-party access and the slots that were there to 11 train operating companies. They are currently in contractual negotiations with Transnet. So what would be the impact? The impact would be that as soon as they have their rolling stock on the network, they are able to take 20 million tons off the road onto the rail network. So that's it. But these things don't move as fast because now remember, you've given them slots. They have to purchase rolling stock. That is, they have to purchase locos. They have to purchase wagons. Depends on the commodity that they're moving. But ultimately, that is an important step that for the first time, we've been able to get third-party access and compete with TFR, Transnet Freight Rail. So I certainly think that is the direction that we're moving in. Similarly, for example, earlier this year, we were introducing private sector participation, never done before, right? In the three corridors, manganese, iron ore, coal, and the general freight. That RFI process has been completed. Our next step is to move to the markets to actually go out and issue a request for proposals, right? Which is going to be the procurement. So I think there's some significant steps that are going to happen over the period, the next few months into 2026, that are going to be important. That's about creating efficiency, reducing the cost, increasing exports, and ultimately South Africa can benefit with growth and investments, and of course, exports earned.
What about putting more effort into building then, you know, the trust? So breaking down that trust deficit, Rudy, because governments published reform trackers, right? But often without independent verification. So why hasn't Operation Vulindlela opened itself up to external performance audits? And, you know, how can citizens trust the progress metrics that are presented by the presidency itself?
So there are two levels, and I like that question, Alicia, because I think those are important. Firstly, as you may know, I mean, the president has initiated a partnership with the Business for South Africa, B4SA. Part of that was to deal with four aspects, to look at energy and how business and ourselves can collaborate in resolving the energy crisis, logistics and transport, crime and corruption, and employment. That partnership started in July 2023. It's gone into its second phase. It's about to go into the third phase for the next year. But that partnership has been an important point. Remember, these are CEOs of many of the firms that are part of the B4SA, 160 CEOs. And that was an important step in building that collaboration. Collaboration builds trust. Trust doesn't come out of thin air, as all of us know. We got to be able to talk through these issues, to confront, to address concerns that we have, both them addressing with us and us addressing with them. So that's an important part. But particularly in this year, we were part of a process from the Business Leadership South Africa that had just launched an independent tracker. And there was an interesting comment that was made that said, and the tracker was precisely to independently track the reform program. And I was part of the process and program to launch it. And I'm extremely happy because independent verification, I mean, we can blow our own horn, right? But it's when independent verification say, well, actually, this process has moved. And someone commented and said, why does government not adopt the tracker? And I said, no, I think that's a bad idea. We've got our own tracking and monitoring process. What we do need is independent, standalone, external verification. So adopting the BLSA tracker is not going to be a good thing for us. We need the BLSA people to tell us, actual fact, what you are saying is not correct. We think that you have not completed the reform. There are a number of two steps that have to be completed. So fully supported, and I think the BLSA tracker as an independent standalone tracker is going to be an important part of that monitoring and evaluation. But generally speaking, I think we've moved leaps and bounds, Alicia, in developing a good collaborative partnership that has started to build trust with business and with government, led by the president, of course.
Rudy, you talk about the progress, and yet about a quarter, I think, of the reforms face significant challenges, right? And that's slowing implementation timelines down. Critical infrastructure like the Transport Economic Regulator, the Independent Water Regulator, the unbundling of Transnet's National Ports Authority, even on the power front. So that's all still on the to-do list. So bottom line, I mean, what's the holdup? What are the key blockages that are hindering ability and willingness to execute on these key national objectives?
So those are all administrative responsibilities. Now, let's take the Transport Economic Regulator. legislation passed, we've got to set it up, we've got to follow the PFMA process, we've got to get National Treasury approval. The board has been appointed, for example. We now got to put into place people that have been employed as a CEO, as a CFO, getting staff done. Those processes are all happening. And I think it's important for us to follow the steps. We don't want people to take us to court and say, you didn't follow administration processes. Similarly with unbundling, it's quite complex. This is what we found out, right? It's simply not easy to unbundle, for example, in the way that you think, like today we decide unbundling and we separate TNPA. There are debt covenants issues, for example. You know, when debt holders who gave debt to Transnet look at Transnet, they don't look at Transnet with TNPA this side and Transnet that side. They look at Transnet inclusive of TNPA. So you've got to deal with those separation and transaction matters, including being able to ensure that there's sufficient amount of confidence that the sovereign is going to stand by with Transnet. Eskom unbundling as well from the NTCSA. Except for Eskom unbundling, we're making pretty good progress. On the 1st of April, we'll be launching the South African wholesale electricity market. That's the first and most critical step when we're launching the actual market for competition in generation, right? And NTCSA being a critical component. The unbundling, including the functional unbundling of the transmission system operator into an independent TSO operator, is an important step that we've got to follow. So I think all of these things are important, but think about this. What we needed to do is get private participation and competition in. We've done that now for it. We are going to introduce private sector participation, and we're going to introduce either concessions or equity stake into the rail system. That's going to be important. We are going to unbundle TNPA. We've introduced in 2022 private sector participation in generation, where you could produce, you could build a generation plant and you could use the network to transport your electrons to wherever customers are. You didn't have to rely on Eskom to facilitate that. And I think those are important and fundamental steps. And that's where you got to see the investments taking place. Of course, the administrative component of creating a truly independent rail and ports authority is going to be critical. A truly independent transmission system operator that will play the role of course, supporting private and including public sector, which will be TFR and Eskom generation, is a steps that we've got to follow, but they're not there yet. That's the important thing. We've got to set up the administration process and ensure that those unbundling does happen. I'm pretty confident that some of the measures that we've taken in Leisha is going to be important in creating that confidence that we do want private sector investment, infrastructure build in those two sectors.
Rudy, how long do you anticipate this taking? Getting administration to where it needs to be.
Let's talk about the transmission system operator. The Electricity Regulator Act actually says, once you've separated and created a subsidiary, so just think about it. There was no subsidiary. The transmission part of Eskom was a division. That's what it was. So we've created a subsidiary that is now Eskom Holdings being the shield. To create a transparent and fair process, Eskom Holdings cannot be the shareholder when the system operator has to purchase, for example, electrons from different generators. So you've got to be transparent. You've got to create a competitive market. Independence is important. We did say that would happen over 5 years in the Electricity Regulatory Act. So actual fact, it's 5 years. We think we can do it much more sooner, right? So there was a specific time and date said in the Electricity Regulatory Act. But we have to, because there's quite a bit of steps that we've got to do to be able to do that. For transport, we've got to ensure that the Transport Economic Regulator is established and set up in next year, and that's what we set up. You know, so once the Transport Economic Regulator is set up, we've got train operating companies that are there. We've got to separate, and so we've created now for the first time a division. That's the first step, division between Transnet Freight Rail and Transnet Infrastructure, right? And then we've got to move to subsidiary, and then, of course, separate money. These are important steps, Alicia, and I think sometimes the onerous nature, the importance of protecting debt holders, markets to be clear about certainty, you may move rapid. And then you suddenly have debt holders calling the debt, and then you're in a crisis, right? So there are important steps that we've got to follow. And I think we have started that process. We are committed to it. And we're going to ensure that we create competitive markets in those network sectors that have never had competition before or true competition before.
Rudy, in this process, what we are moving away from is a siloed approach, right? Things happening independently.
What we refer to, Alicia, as vertically integrated, right?
Exactly.
One entity doing everything from top to bottom, right? And that's what we've got to do. And that's what the unbundling is about. So we use those words unbundling. We're unbundling Transnet, we're unbundling Eskom. And that is because we want to create competition. We've got to have other generators. We've got to have other train operating companies on the network. We've got to have other port operators on the port system, not only TPT, for example. That's the point about it. And competition creates efficiency, brings down the cost, and it attracts private investment that we so sorely need in our economy.
Okay, so that said then, Rudy, I mean, many of the reforms, you know, from energy to logistics to water depend on cooperation across departments and SOEs, and both of those notorious for inefficiency. So why has the presidency not been able to overcome that despite this, supposed whole of government approach?
No, but it's not. I think that's not correct, Alicia. I think we are cooperating. This is the point about Operation Vulindlela. It has its ability from the presidency to coordinate across departments. That's why the collaboration was set up between ourselves and National Treasury, with the president himself taking full ownership of Operation Vulindlela. It is to break down that silence. And to break down the silence, precisely how we've gotten to. Think about energy. 16 departments that participate in the energy space. Part of that was to arrest, firstly, the crisis in energy by establishing the National Energy Crisis Committee. Part of that was also the reform programs as a significant step in that. So we are breaking down. They are cooperation. This is the most successful and most unique feature of OVI, that we are able to bring together different departments, different levels of government in a cooperative manner, including the entities, to be able to work through how we ensure that the reform is successful.
Yeah.
So I think that is exactly what we are doing. We're getting back to doing that, you know, coordinating. We can't have silos. We can't have departments that are running off in different directions and not in line with cabinet decisions or policy decisions that have been taken. That's
Rudy,
precisely why we...
Sorry to interrupt.
We're not here to implement, right?
So this is what I want to get to, because, you know... implementation now sees a lot riding on local government, but you've been emphatic about the fact that this doesn't mean that you step in and take over. It's a collaborative approach where you're simply stepping in to, coordinate and provide support. Are you confident that that's going to be enough? I mean, what's being put in place to hold these departments accountable to implementation and follow through on time and within budget?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's an important part. So I know sometimes we think about introducing legislation to make us all powerful. That cannot be the case. We've got to have a collaborative approach, right? And the level of accountability that we introduce is simply that we, I don't know if you're familiar with the government system, we have an annual performance plan. Annual performance plans reflect precisely the reform that we got to do. And annual performance plans are held accountable in its achievements by having performance agreements. So the president has a performance agreement with the minister. The minister has a performance agreement with the director general, and the director general has a performance agreement with the staff responsible for the reforms. What we do is to ensure that the performance agreement reflects specifically those reforms. And as you know, we're quite particular about time-bound reforms and ensuring that it's resourced. And so that's the level of accountability where the president is able to engage with the minister on his performance agreement, and the minister is able to engage with the DG and the rest of the staff in the department to ensure that happens. But in OVI, we have another unique ability to ensure that there's a level of accountability, and that has, for example, stock takes. And we do regular stock takes. And stock takes is really the president, supported by ourselves in the technical area in the background, engaging with the minister on successes, challenges, even on where there are challenges on performance. You know, he's able to have frank conversations with the minister and the department around that. So this is all part of a mechanism to ensure that we do introduce accountability and we do that. That report that we launched a few weeks ago, Alicia, on the second quarter, we take that to cabinet and we're quite frank as it is. We say, well, we've made progress on these aspects, but these are the two areas that we're not making progress and we're worried about it being delayed significantly. So, cabinet colleagues, cabinet ministers, president, we may require an intervention or no. These are delayed because of particular delays around administration, for example. We've got to advertise and stuff like that. So these are going to be an important part of the system that we introduce around accountability. Performance is the one thing that I think we're quite pedantic on, Alicia. I don't think we want to introduce legislation to say, if you don't do this, we're going to whip you over or haul you over the coals. I think there's sufficient mechanisms in the system. What we've got to do, and I think this is the critique, which is that we've got to implement those accountability mechanisms.
Yeah.
Hold people to account. And that's what I think is the sort of importance of Operation Vulindlela.
So does that filter through then to municipalities, Rudy? I mean, 66% of municipalities are distressed financially. 64 out of the 257 are deemed dysfunctional. And I mean, therein lies the skepticism, right? Where this is no longer a governance issue. It's gotten to a point where this is an issue of national stability. And so accountability at that level becoming even more imperative.
So it doesn't filter through because, remember, local government has its own system. It's governed by the Constitution, right? Firstly, the Municipal Systems Act and the Municipal Finance Management Act. So this is the tricky thing with our levels of government. We have limited power at the national or provincial level. You know, there's distinct functions, responsibility, including legislative responsibilities that are there. We can't just jump in and say to municipalities, we're taking over. There are processes that you've got to follow, pieces in the legislation. So it is a bit tricky when we put this as a reform, knowing full well that we're going to have to develop a collaborative partnership with municipalities. But firstly, I mean, we can't take all 260-odd municipalities. So we needed to think through how do we prioritize. And our prioritization was the metros, because number one, it's probably just over 60% of GDP. And secondly, it has more than 60% of the total population. If you add in the secondary cities, that would be about 70 municipalities inclusive of the metros, then suddenly you see a different dynamic. About 80% of the 75 to 80% of the population and equally the size of GDP. So it's important that when we decided on the reform, we decided on those specific reforms. And the two reforms that are going to be quite critical was the two trading services, which is water and electricity, and about ring fencing that to improve service delivery. The second one was around professionalization, separating that strong political interface between the elected politicians and the professional professional managers, right? Because we wanted to make that separation simply to myself, right? There's the public service, framework that, gives guidance and how we professionalize ourselves. We wanted to extend that to professionals within the public, to within local government as well. Then there's the white paper as well, and as well also reviewing the fiscal framework for municipalities. So those are important things that was in our control. But ultimately, if you want to fix that, we needed to collaborate in the same way that we collaborate with different partners across government. We didn't want to introduce legislative changes or use the legislative parameters of taking municipalities under administration. Those tools are there. But it's about working through the system with that. So it is going to be a bit slow. There are tools in our domain that we can use to be able to do that. For example, through the trading services, which is the Metro Trading Service incentives that has been there. But it is a tough space. I don't dispute that. I think it is going to be difficult. But at least I think the focus on few that has 8% or 60% in this instance, and has greater impact on GDP is going to be important. And it is about service delivery. It is about improving efficiency, transparency, about reducing costs, ensure that we deliver basic services to people at the end of the day in our over-reform for local government.
And why it's key is because it really then becomes pointless you doing what you're doing at your level if it doesn't filter through, right? So absolutely. This brings us to the key question then, because, you know, there is a risk that this all falls to nothing. I mean, I know that there's no, and you've been emphatic about this, that there's no legal pathway yet for wholesale privatization of water distribution. We know that PPP frameworks exist, but that's limited. Is there any threshold of persistent failure that would justify, you know, partial private sector management, or is that politically off limits?
I think you've got to be very careful about this, right? So when you get to the coalface and service delivery, even when you talk about private sector participation in water services, for example, right? You've got to be careful about cost, because this is not impacting on consumers, right? Directly households or businesses that would have to buy them. I certainly think that in big infrastructure projects, particularly when you can secure, where you are unable to get the fiscal support internally, you've got to think about how one designs these partnerships at the end of the day. Right now, in the distribution sector, there are two successful private sector partners, one in KZN and one in Mbombela. I think it was designed, and quite interesting, right? They were designed in the early 2000s, and their concessions are coming towards an end. Mixed sort of messages of what was success and not success, but I think there's lots of lessons to be learned, and so we got to think about the role of the private sector. But you're spot on. If we fix electricity here at a national level, let's just say we do generation and we separate, and we do that, the key thing is that isn't it ultimately you want electricity to be delivered to the house or to the business? That's in a municipality. So that distribution is important, similarly for water, right? So those are going to be important factors that we've got to work on. I certainly think that we don't want to say, we don't necessarily need wholesale privatization. I don't think that's a panacea to the problem that we have, but certainly we've got to lock in private sector where they're able to play a role. Ultimately, what we've got to do is run better administration. So we've got to ensure that there's better administration to be able to ensure that you deliver on your constitutional mandate as local government. That's what it's about, right? You can't wish away or sort of delegate your functions to other people. You've got to run that. But we've got to be tighter. And that's why I think the local government white paper process, Alicia, is also important. At what point do you intervene? At what point do you say, I've seen this trend, you know, happening over a few years. We've got to help you. We've got to assist you to be able to ensure we reverse this trend. Because the next step, if we don't do this, is that you suddenly see, boom, a decline and a collapse in services. It's then too late, right? And that's the reality. I think sometimes our interventions are much too late. But we see that trend. We see the red flashing lights. It's coming. The train is going to hit us. But we can't intervene because the legislative powers demand that we follow due process. So I think the debate around, for example, the local government white paper that most people have been quite interested in is about saying, how do we create that intergovernment support system? Not to take over, not to undermine elected political leaders that are in the municipality, not to undermine officials that are governed by separate pieces of legislation, but simply to ensure that as a country, we're able to work together to collaborate and deliver basic services to our people. And that's going to be fundamental. I think that's the tricky thing that we've got to talk through when we finally get the white paper adopted and it's a policy stance. And then the most important part of the white paper is to cascade that into the existing legislation. That's going to be that's when the rubber hits the road.
Look, it's a tricky balancing act, but it's an act that needs to be performed, Rudy, if we are going to unlock private investment and build state capability and place South Africa on a new growth trajectory, right? So absolutely. I want to ask you where the presidency has highlighted that the reform drive continues to unlock this private investment. Can you give us a rand value of private investment directly attributable to Vulindlela reforms that have come through?
Yeah, I mean, we ran a bit of a model through the Treasury, and we estimated on the basis of the first phase of reforms, we've been able to unlock about 500 billion rand worth of investment. Three quarters of that, in actual fact, 90% of that is new generation in the electricity sector. So we that's evidence-based, and you can go to, you know, there are many data points, Alicia, that you can see. Just go to the registration, for example, on the NERSA portal, and the registration is quite an important part, because when you register, you're at a point where you've been able to get your grid connection or at least your budget quote not approved yet. But your next step is then once you've registered, you can go to financial close. So those are important steps, right? And I think 500 billion, we've looked at some of the other aspects, telecommunications, for example, because once we did the auction of the 4G and 5G spectrum, there was a big uptick in investment we saw and reducing in the cost, of course, of broadband, 50% reduction in 1 gigabyte data, for example. And if you've got kids, you see that happening when you're buying airtime for them. But also in the water sector as well. By simply approving and having a more efficient system on water use licenses, with 75% of water use licenses being issued within 3 months. So you can see that, right? Now, it means that you've unlocked that. Doesn't mean that all of it is spent at the end of it, but it's investments that will now have to take place, because once you have registration and once you've spent your budget quote, you now have to construct, right? So that's an important part of it. We've got to continuously look at that and run the models to see, is the reform achieving its objective? And that is locking in investment by the private sector and by the public sector. But I think those are good indicators for us. Now, of course, 500 billion is useful. But if you talk about growth, right? So let's assume 3% growth. 3% requires, for example, 18 to 20% fixed capital formation. Right.
So it's now sitting at what, 13, 14?
Yeah. 3% requires 18 to 20%. Where are we? We're at 14%, right? As a percentage investment, as a percentage of GDP. What's the size of the economy? Let's round it off nicely, because it's probably about 7.7, 7.8 trillion rand, 8 trillion rand. So it's a nice figure, right? So let's just say 20% of that would require, for example, 1.6 trillion rand. 500 billion that we've unlocked, right? Plus probably some investments that are there in the infrastructure space and water. We're far off, right? That's why we're getting 14. We got to see a significant jump in fixed capital formation, and that's the most important part. So you break those numbers down. It's quite interesting to see what we require. We require not just 500 billion, we require trillion rand or more above what we already investing. That's a huge number, right? And that is not just once off. That's annual investment in investment.
And that's a lofty requirement, right? So I've got to ask you before I let you go, where business confidence, where investor confidence surveys consistently cite then, you know, crime, corruption, lack of rule of law as top deterrence, Rudy. Why hasn't organized crime and accountability been treated as an economic reform priority, given its direct link to investor confidence? Surely that's going to be, you know, part of the catalyst to unlock this and open the taps.
So certainly not an over-announced reform in the way that we formally done it, but certainly as an area in the collaboration with business. And we're working pretty hard around that. And for instance, the big focus is around organized crime. If you deal with organized crime, for example, let's just take a few elements of that. For example, the ability for people who come on construction sites and say, pay us 30%, the mafia around that, or the ability for people who are stealing coal, for instance, you know, or the ability for those who are engaged in copper theft and, and ferrous metal trades, for example, right? Organized crime is an important focus. We are saying it.
Organized crime within government as well.
We've
got to look at both sides of the equation. Yeah.
No, I'm teasing you. But it's certainly something that we've got to look at. And it is an impact. It impacts 10% on our, our ability to grow. It has a significant impact. And of course, when global investors come here and they don't feel safe with the investments, I'm not talking about money. I'm talking about real greenfields investments. I'm building a factory over here. Is it going to be safe? Is it going to be broken into and stuff stolen or burned down? Those are the things that we've got to fundamentally address. So we can't separate crime as something over there that someone else must deal and the economy must continue there. It is so integrated that we've got to deal with it in a manner that I think is important. But here's the thing. I don't agree with you on some of the business indicators. I've seen last quarter business indicators uptick in positive sentiment on some of the aspects. And these are some of the business indicators that are run independently. seeing an uptick in, for example, producer sentiments, an uptick in confidence. You can have that uptick in manufacturing confidence, uptick in perceptions. I think that's an important, how do we maintain that? And I certainly think with the great listing matter now behind us, cost of capital becoming much more cheaper, the reforms continuing to gain pace and to be implemented, I certainly think that's the sentiment that we've got to work on, and we've got to show that we can change, we can fix this economy, we can deal with our challenges, and we can work together with the private sector. So for me, I think that's going to be the sort of positive note. But it has to be not words, man. That's my point about why OV is such an important part. We don't mix words. We certainly don't just go on the you know, love and fresh air, if I should say that jokingly. It's about the hard implementation of some of the most difficult stuff that we got ahead. Okay. It's about the collaboration with business, convincing them to do the investments that are required. For me, I think that's the sort of confidence that I'm hoping we will end in this year, right? And I think we are on that track where 2026 PSPs now announce. Train operating companies on the freight logistics on the freight network, the South African wholesale electricity market launched on the 1st of April. Those are important sort of indicators for us that I think are going to be important and perpetuate that sort of confidence there, where we can now see the hard investment actually being done. Locals on there that have been purchased somewhere else or built somewhere else. Generation plants being constructed and competing in the limited market that we're going to set up and build that. PSPs being announced. For example, sorry, I forgot to mention this one. The ability for the two players who were fighting each other in court on the PSP in Durban Container Terminal 2, Pier 2, right? Being resolved. And both players saying, we're not going to go to court. Please go ahead, Transnet, with the transaction, right? And remember, it was a 49% sale of stake to the Filipinos. ICTSI, 11.5 billion, signing their check, getting it into Transnet, running a more efficient port. These are such important indicators that are going to be able to break that perception that we have and getting investment going.
Look, yeah, you talk about perceptions being broken, but ultimately the critical test of reform success is going to be whether we can get this economy growing. Rudy, unfortunately, we're out of time. We're going to have to leave it there. But thanks so much for having joined us today. Rudy Dix is head of the Project Management Office in the Presidency and co-lead of Operation Vulindlela. To you, our audience, thank you for watching. And remember, the series is free, it's shareable, it's accessible to anyone, whether you're a PSG client or not. From me, Alicia Sekhem, it's goodbye until next time.